It is Tuesday, January 21st, 2014. Wow. And this is episode 51 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as usual, joining me tonight is Mr. Andrew Callett.
Good evening.
Good evening. So, you know, we have a time budget again. This time it's not my fault, so...
Hey, for once, I have a social life.
You know? nothing wrong with that.
What can I say?
So let's get into it. First thing I have is, following tradition. And by the way, based on feedback from our listeners, apparently, you know, everybody only likes Bob, I guess. So Bob gave me something to talk about today. It was actually about cats and cats and the importance of patching privilege escalation. So you know, I think a lot of people and a lot of organizations kind of deprioritize local privilege escalation bugs, right? You know, because, hey, you got to get on the system and anyway. So there's a really cool tool, I guess, that Bob found in the midst of an attack called Mimikatz. And Mimikatz basically groks LSAS and pulls out plain text passwords.
Awesome.
And so if you have a Windows system that in any way, shape, or form lets someone log on with no privileges or lower privileges, and you have a active privilege escalation bug, they can totally own you, because this will allow them, no decryption required, no hashcat, no nothing. They can just get your password. Doesn't matter how complex or long your password is. Doesn't matter if you're using Kerberos tickets. Doesn't matter. They get the plain text password.
And how is that possible? That's one thing I'm trying to figure out.
I need to look into the details.
But, I mean, that's like saying like that the admin password is stored in a text file and /.
Well, I should say that Bob, this is what Bob told me, right? You have to attack somebody who's actively logged in. So you can't, you can't pull out a password for just any old account. You have to wait for someone to log in, and then you can grab their password. So apparently the LSAS process stores for the duration of their login session, your plain text password.
Wow.
In some kind of memory data structure. So
it just seems wrong. I got to look into this.
Awesome.
I got to look into this.
Bob gave me a link. I'll send it to you.
Did Bob mention anything about, making sure your company has good earnings?
Ouch. Damn. That hurt. I'm really hurt.
What? I'm talking about Bob's company.
Okay, fine. So moving on, by the way, if you're tired of Target, if you're tired of the Target news, you should probably just turn the show off.
You come to the wrong place.
Because this is not the podcast for you. I'm sorry.
To be fair, you could just skip to like 30 minutes from now.
Fair enough.
And we'll probably be done with the Target stuff.
Yep.
But it's not our fault. There's so much to be learned.
Exactly. And that's why I want to talk about it.
It's ripe with lessons.
I don't want to, just be clear, right? I don't want to pile on. We're not going to pile on here. This is hopefully a productive discussion.
And we like to think some of you actually get useful news from here that you don't get someplace else. So maybe you want the updates because we get them for you.
Hey, good point.
It's possible.
Good sales job.
It could be that they rely on us, Jerry, for their InfoSec news.
You should work in sales.
I have a soul.
Okay, so with that.
Hey, here's an idea. Let's talk about Target.
Yeah, the first story we have, this is a very brief posting on Securosa's site by Rich Mogul. And he pulled out a bit of text about from a story that we're going to talk about in a minute. And I thought it was worth talking about separately. You know, we've dogged, and I personally have dogged on antivirus for quite some time. And I think it's pretty well worthwhile. But I think this is a really good opportunity to point out kind of the key weakness. And so essentially, you know, we know that the piece of malware that was used in the Target attack has been found. And, you know, it was run through, I think it was VirusTotal, and none of the antivirus engines picked it up. And, you know, honestly, that shouldn't really surprise anyone because, you know, look, I got to take a side diversion for a second, right? I have lots of discussions with people about attacks like this. I see them, unfortunately, fairly frequently. And the discussion inevitably leads to, wow, that's an advanced attack. How advanced did they have to be? Was this a state-sponsored thing? And you know, the reality is, it's not all that hard anymore to bypass antivirus. There's toolkits that let you do this. There's lots of information on how to do this. It's pretty well worn path. So keep that in mind, right? This is not advanced attacking, you know, a 400 level class. This is pretty basic stuff these days. And it's important to understand that, you know, antivirus, as demonstrated in this attack, isn't anymore really a primary attack, a primary defense against these kinds of attacks.
No, it really isn't. And this is a great example of what we've been talking about for a while, which is things go best AV. What's also interesting is that a lot of the evidence of this seems to have disappeared, according to Brian Krebs. The VirusTotal page that covered some of this is gone. There's a bunch of the stuff online that was gone. But of course, you can't ever really delete things from the internet. They're always archives. So it's interesting to me that they're trying to bury this information right now. Now, I'm not saying there's some vast right-wing conspiracy, but I'm saying it's interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there was also, and I need to find the link to that story, but there was a, I think it was Threat Expert. There was something about it having been posted to that site a while ago. And at the time, it wasn't detected as anything malicious. It was just kind of hanging out there.
Yeah.
And I think the way it was found, or at least the way the association was made, is that, you know, once after the breach was over and somebody looked at the the hash of the file, they went and searched for that hash, and lo and behold, there it's sitting out on, I'm not sure if it was VirusTotal or Threat Expert, one of the sites. Somebody had already uploaded it and did an evaluation.
So theoretically, that means the bad guys were checking to see if it was going to get flagged.
The only thing that makes me think that they wouldn't do that, you know, and the pen test people will tell you it's a really horrible idea to upload your payload.
Because it'll go straight, in theory, straight to the AV vendors.
Exactly.
Right, which was the next point that I was kind of thinking of. Why didn't it?
That's the real question. That's like the million-dollar question right there.
Yeah.
So, anyhow.
But anyway, point is, AV, fail.
Yeah, it has its place, but you know, that ain't it. So the next point is actually, there's a couple of related articles. iSight Partners has put out a really thin amount of detail publicly, and there behind that there is a relatively detailed report that goes through their deconstruction of the malware. And unfortunately, it's not a public report, so we can't really talk about it much.
But Bob got us a copy.
But Bob did get us a copy. And you know, it's interesting because it does in some ways match what's publicly, you know, been publicly discussed, and in some ways it's a little bit different. You know, hopefully at some point this will become more public and we can share some of the details, because there are some pretty cool aspects of it.
Wow, we just completely teased the audience. That wasn't nice.
I know.
We didn't mean to sound that sort of arrogant and we're, you know, we have cool access and you don't. Well, Jerry might have, but
I got Bob. I mean, what can I say?
I bet this will come out. You know, the reason that this report went out is to other retailers to help them defend themselves. So I keep hearing this is getting leaked all over the damn place, so it's probably pretty easy to find at this point. So
once I see it publicly available,
yeah, no. I'm just saying,
wraps come off and we're covering it.
If our listeners just happen to Google search, they might potentially come across it.
Yeah.
Just saying. Point is, it's out there and it's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I've read it. I wasn't. Did it cover initial infection vector?
No.
Okay. That's no. What I thought.
So there's been a fair number of investigative articles. I think one of them was from the New York Times, where they had interviewed some, you know, quote, insiders. And I think it was the New York Times that actually, I read it this afternoon, had a pretty interesting timeline. But the sources they cite said that the initial attack vector was a compromised web server.
Right. I've seen that speculation. I'm still putting it in the speculation camp as opposed to confirmed fact.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously they believe it's fact, but, you know, they're right. Not citing who said it. So you got to take it for what it's worth.
But that's interesting, right? Because that's a really noisy way to come into an organization. Popping a web browser is really noisy. I would have bet my money that I was going to be phishing.
I would have too. And, you know, I still wonder if, you know, that's not a possibility, you know. So could this have been an intranet server or what have
you? I mean, there's another possibility, which could have been a blended attack where, you know, ooh, big word. They popped a web server and used that as a watering hole attack to phish internal folks.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just, popping a web server is so noisy. You know, that's a box that's got a lot of folks watching it, in theory.
And they're usually isolated. They're not usually, hopefully, kids, you don't have a way in from your web server to your network.
So, sure. Don't know. To be continued on that, I'd love to know more. But again, we could, on my side of the pond, we had a big thread going in our company about different things that could or couldn't have happened. And, you know, somebody said, and I agree with him, hey, let's be clear here about what is fact and what is speculation, because, you know, a lot of people, especially, sales guys, repeat what they hear. They're kind of like four-year-olds. And so if they want to talk, you know, target, and they hear an engineer talking about, well, it might have been this, they'll go out there and start talking about it as fact, then everybody's credibility is hurt and people look silly. And anyway, point being, I try really hard to differentiate between fact and speculation.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah,
that definitely is fair. But, you know, there are some other details. Again, the veracity of them are questionable about the exfiltration. I know. So we talked.
Yeah,
we talked about that last time, and I think it was in the same article, the referenced method of exfiltration, because the POS terminals didn't actually have outbound connectivity to the internet,
which is good.
Which is good. Yeah. But apparently, the attackers had set up some kind of a collection server in the Targa network and were uploading on some periodic basis the data to this internal server and then exfiltrating it.
Which makes sense. And it goes back to monitoring your internal traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, we saw that with the state of South Carolina breach last year. That was exactly how that happened. By the way, the web server attack, that was exactly how TJ Maxx was hacked way back when. It was how was it DigiNotar? Yeah, DigiNotar. How they got owned? You know, it's a pretty common thing. And you know, one of the things that bothers me is we as an industry don't seem to be learning from some of these lessons on with respect to architecture.
Yeah.
You know, and we seem to be enamored with technology and controls working right. But, you know, my observation, my experience is that they don't often work right. And I see people under-engineer things. And, and you know, you have a failure because you didn't anticipate something. And now somebody has full access to your network. And, you know, we've seen that in quite a few breaches. Obviously, we don't know enough about Target yet.
Right. But no, it's true. I was having a discussion with a company last week about malware and malware defense. And whenever I brought up the idea of re-architecture, they really sort of push back on that. They want drop a box on my network and make it go away. Obviously, re-architecting the network is a bigger pain, has a lot more downtime. You know, but maybe that leads to we should be designing these networks to begin with, not with only the concept of pushing packets as efficiently as possible, Cisco, but, you know, having security mindset.
Absolutely. And I think part of this, by the way, this is something that has started to resonate with me that, you know, the field of IT security is more like a craft than a science. You know, it's very much up to the opinions and eccentricities and fears and whatnot of the person who is designing and setting things up.
And I would say that's an extension of the company too, right? You know, the company's needs, wants, ability to tolerate risk, budget.
Yeah, absolutely.
Culture, how restrictive they're willing to be in terms of their controls. I think that all comes into play.
Yeah, for sure. So, while I'm talking about things that bother me, I am really getting tired of people quoting the number of credit cards that were breached at 110 million. It's 110 million records, 40 million credit card numbers, 70 million names, addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses. Okay, people, get it right.
And get off his lawn.
Get off my lawn. I don't know. It just bothers me a lot.
Accuracy matters.
I listen to a lot of podcasts, and God, it pisses me off when I hear people just very casual with things like that. So
that's fine. You know, some people are upset over the erosion of our civil liberties and massive surveillance state and the loss of freedom. But you know, you could be upset about that.
Hey, we all gotta stand for something, right? So,
but no, you're correct. We should, you know, as professionals in this field, we should get this right. It matters.
Yes. Fair enough. So, you know, there's an interesting thing I wanted to bring up relative to the to what's being reported and what's in that, you know, secret report.
the pieces of malware are not the same, and I'll kind of leave it there. They're apparently similar, but they're not. So, you know, which by the way is an interesting theme on what we were just talking about. You know, there's a lot of articles out there right now talking about, you know, the target malware being Black POS. And, you know, there's a very real possibility that's not actually what it is.
Yeah, and there was some firm, and I suddenly am blanking on the name, who named the author of Black POS, some 17-year-old Russian kid, not necessarily the guy who had anything to do with the attacks, but just authored Black POS. And then Krebs was coming out saying, nope, they're wrong, that's not him. And then, so take everything with a grain of salt, I think is part of the key thing here when we start naming authors.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that can really ruin reputations and lives.
You know, again, take this with a grain of salt because, you know, it was on Twitter, so it must be true.
Well, they're not allowed to put it on Twitter if it's not true.
It's true. How can you lie in 140 characters? I mean, come on. The kid who was accused of this also, when asked, didn't deny it. And said something along the lines of, well, I knew it could have potentially been used for evil, but that's not my problem kind of thing. So I don't know what to believe on that one at this point, other than I think a lot of people right now are trying to make a name for themselves and grab as much headlines as they can. And if they can get their name attached to the target situation, much like we are, they can get some press, get some Google hits, get bought for $1 billion later, you know.
Yeah, and... You know, just to be clear, right, that our horse in this race is not breaking new news. It's more about figuring out what this means for us, you know, because there's plenty of other people out there who can speculate about crap, but, you know, that's not what we're here for.
Expert analysis.
Expert analysis. That's right. Exactly.
And soon we'll have experts.
We're working on it, people. Give us time. All right. So the other interesting thing, and this was, I guess, kind of tongue in cheek from F-Secure. F-Secure pointed out that there was a story a couple of years ago about, and I, at the time, I remember this took the internet like a firestorm, about how Target had identified a you know, with their big data analysis, right? They you know, they know certain things about you based on what you buy, and so in this particular case, a teenage girl was sent coupons for I think it at the time it was baby formula, or, you know, it was expectant mom stuff. And the dad hit, as I recall, the dad hit the ceiling and got really angry at Target. How could they do that, you know, to his precious teenage daughter? Well, as it turns out, she indeed was pregnant, and they knew that because she followed a very apparently well-known pattern of purchases that match, you know, what women who are pregnant buy.
And so, God, are we going to get hate mail?
I know. It's going to be great. I'm sending them all to you. So the point of the F-Secure article is, you know, what's the likelihood that this, you know, really private data mining or mined data was also stolen among, you know, amongst the 70 million records?
It's entirely possible. You know, it's probably... All right, so let's think about how you would actually store this information. It's probably not readily identifiable as buyer's behavior data. It's probably in a bunch of code. I don't mean encrypted code. I mean just sort of like shorthand on their databases, right? I mean, it's probably not as obvious as bought, you know, antibiotics this day and bought, you know, I don't know, suppositories that day and bought... You know, mustard. You know, it's probably like, you know, bought product X23, and then I don't know. So that was a really articulate statement.
I was going to go with pickles and ice cream, but yeah, hey, whatever.
So it might be something that's not easily usable is what I'm trying to say. It might be in there, but unless you knew the data format and the data sort of how and why and where it was being utilized, because it probably is not stored in the raw, it probably isn't all that usable. But it's an interesting thing to speculate about, and it's probably true, you know, especially when there's so many interesting things you could do with metadata nowadays.
Yeah, although, you know, I have zero insight into this, so
yeah.
I'll wildly speculate that this is probably something that they outsource.
Yeah.
It's probably not even on their systems, you know, because there's, I, in different, you know, forums have crossed paths with companies who do that for other companies. You know, they, and it's a relatively specialized science. So I'm not saying Target doesn't have that capability in house, but I'm with you. I would expect that, you know, there isn't a broad need to access, you know, that data. That's probably relatively, you know, even if it's wide open, it's probably not very clear where it is and what it is.
Yeah, because I gotta imagine they pull that into some deep analytics. Exactly. And really crunch on it. And you know, if you're just getting the raw tables, I don't know that Russian bad guys are going to do a lot with that on the black market. Now, if you handed it to a state, you know, I'm sure somebody like the NSA or the FBI or equivalent organizations. It. Yeah, it's true. That's true.
But what I was going to say is I would imagine it's a hell of a lot more than 70 million records.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're probably talking tens or hundreds of billions of records.
You know who would really care about that is probably competitors.
Yes.
You know.
Hey. What was Walmart doing this time, during this time?
Yeah, well, just wait for the file to show up on torrent sites. And
there you go.
See if any IPs from Bentonville, Arkansas connect.
All right, so moving on. The next story we have, you know, this is not kind of our mainstream thing here. You know what? I want to go back for one second. So last week, in last week's podcast, I mentioned something about a conversation I had with a bank fraud person. And I talked about how, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, anyway, about how the U.S. banks had chosen to implement their anti-fraud on the back end versus a lot of the other parts of the world used the chip and PIN to implement it on the front end. And one of our listeners wrote in and pointed out that there was a discussion about this on episode 10 of the Risk Science podcast. So one of the ladies on that podcast is also in risk management for a financial institution, and she goes on a rant about that. So that's if you're interested in that, that's something to go take a look at. I'll put a link to them in the show notes. And by the way, if you're not listening to that podcast, you know, when you're done with this podcast, obviously, go listen to that one. They only have one a month, but they're pretty awesome. So
before we jump off target, there's one thing that I want to bring up too that I found earlier today that I'd forgotten about, which was that Target also had a big breach in 2005. So this is not their first big breach. And
yeah, that was all part of the TJ Maxx, mm-hmm. Hartford, that whole mess. The guy behind that's in jail, right?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. Maybe, probably.
I think so.
So you know, it's one thing. You know, we often say there are two types of companies: those who have been breached and those who will be breached. For these guys to have already had a big breach and not get a little bit more hardened internally is not good. Not good.
So that's, I want to save that thought for the last thing we're going to talk about.
Okay.
Because I think that's an important segue. So just, we'll go through this last thing and then we'll go back to that. So here we have a story. This is a link to a story on Slashdot about how Solutionary has released a report.
Hey, before you jump into that.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. Sure. We'd had a note here talking about, you know, what the PCI Council response will be to all these breaches.
Thank you. My notes are scattered. So
No worries. I'm here to keep you on track.
So that's a good point. Let's hypothesize for a second and say that indeed the PCI Council doesn't throw Target under the bus and say that, you know, they were out of control. We all know, and everybody that's been around the industry laughs about how PCI is not the same as security, right? And so it's not hard to imagine a scenario where a company is fully PCI compliant and has a major breach.
I don't have to imagine it. I see it.
well, so let's assume here for a second that indeed Target in every respect was PCI compliant.
I think that's a safe assumption, because otherwise how could they be processing credit cards?
Well, so here's...
Either they've passed, or they've got mitigating controls in place, or they're getting fined.
Well, but the PCI Council has a sordid history.
Mm-hmm.
Once a company gets breached, they kind of say, basically, they're not PCI compliant.
So we've got Target, we've got Neiman Marcus, and up to 6 other retailers.
Yes.
Undisclosed at the moment, involved with this. Major retailers who have major external QSAs auditing their compliance.
And they're tier one too, by the way.
Right.
I mean, so none of this self, big guys.
None of this self questionnaire stuff, right? Full on, you got to pay a lot of money. Have a nice day. And they all got popped. So does this show us that PCI is relatively useless? You could argue that PCI diminishes the attack surface. It's a best effort, minimal best effort. They're better off with it than without it. But at some point, the credibility of the PCI Council and the PCI requirement starts to come into question in my mind. And can these companies say back to PCI, but we did what you said, and yeah, we still got hacksword?
Yeah, basically, this starts to get into some interesting legal territory of due care and safe harbor, right?
Yep.
So, you know, does living up to the the letter of the law of PCI constitute, you know, due care and safe harbor? Is Target held? Can Target be held harmless because they were compliant? And that's going to be a question for the courts.
I'm going to vote no.
Me too.
I think the key takeaway here is that if you're only securing your systems up to PCI level, you're doing a vast disservice to your company. And I think it's incumbent upon InfoSec practitioners to educate their company's executive ranks that PCI is a bare minimum and is not security.
Yeah, it's just the common elements. It is not tailored to your specific
right
risks, your specific profile, your specific applications and all of that. And by the way, I see that in a lot of large companies where policy or regulatory requirements are kind of viewed by, on the one hand, the regulatory body, whether that's, you know, the CIO or the security group, as kind of a meets minimum. You know, this is the minimum bar. You need to figure out what additional you should do for your particular organization. And at the same time, those, the business teams see that as kind of the high watermark. If I can just get past the PCF, I can just pass PCI, you know, that's the goal. I've heard tell that Target in many ways exceeded the requirements of PCI, but my specific thinking around this question was, what will be the PCI Council's response to this? You know, we know that
for instance, version, was it version 3 or 4 of PCI is coming out real soon.
3.0.
I think it's going to take effect in January of next year. You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to, are they going to release an addendum that deals with RAM scrapers, or are they going to, you know, bolster the requirement for network segmentation, or, you know, what are they going to do?
I personally, not that anyone's asked me, I would say that if they want to be smart, the prevention side of this game is not going to do it. It's not going to cut it. So you've got to go to breach detection and start adding in breach detection techniques to PCI.
To minimize loss, yeah.
Right? Because if this were, you know, instead of 40 million credit cards, 1,000 credit cards, that's manageable. That's acceptable level of shrink.
You know?
If you caught it in the first day, okay. I think it's unwinnable to keep the bad guys out, is what I'm saying. And so you have to be better at detecting them once they're in.
Yeah. So, while we're off on a tangent here, I got to thinking about this a little bit. So who loses here? Who loses in this game?
Yeah.
And you know, obviously we, the consumers, we don't really lose. Obviously, if it's a debit card and, you know, we don't report it within 2 days, at least here in the U.S., you know, we're covered. If it's a credit card, we're covered.
You know, I saw one friend post something about this today that I hadn't thought about. Let's say you've got a debit card or a credit card. It's been popped. Your card issuing agency is forcing you to replace it. If you got a bunch of auto pays going on, and you haven't caught them all, that could cause you some pain.
True. But you're not losing thousands of dollars.
Correct. And so, end of the day, it's not your liability.
Yeah. So follow me for a second here, because now in this case, Target, obviously they're going to get their pants sued off. They're up to 70 lawsuits. You know, so they're going to incur a lot of fees, but they're not going to incur a lot of, or possibly any loss as a direct result of what was stolen from the credit cards, right? They're not, as far as I know, they're not going to, they're not going to pay back Visa or MasterCard or any of the banks. And so it's my understanding it's the financial institutions and Visa and MasterCard who are really out there. But, correct, you know, those guys have pretty complicated formulas for figuring out, you know, risk, loss, and fees. And so, you know, if they have to ratchet up their processing fee from, let's say, 2.9% to 2.95% to cover this, do they really care? I mean, does it, you know, who actually suffers here?
That's a good point.
I'm having a hard time with this.
You're right. At the end of the day, the whole reason PCI exists is to limit the liability and risk for the card issuers, which tells me the card issuers are the ones who are going to eat the shrink, right? They're the ones who issue it, and if there's fraud involved, it's on the card issuers to deal with it. So you're right. If at the end of the day they bump up their charge rate a little bit, you know, really it's we, the consumers, who will absorb that hit.
Right. But
it's not going to put Visa or MasterCard out of business. It's going to put Amex out of business.
It's not going to put any of the banks out of business. It's not going to put Target out of business. It's going to come back on us. But, you know, it's an interesting perspective, because it isn't just going to be Target shoppers.
Right.
That's going to be across the entire industry, you know, the entire population. And so it's going to be pretty well diluted. So, you know, it's an interesting problem. And I think potentially points to why there's not a lot of motivation to do more here.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
You know, so we could spend billions of dollars for what?
And, you know, the reality is, when all this is said, cut and dried, how much fraud has actually been committed on these cards? That'd be an interesting question to know, because of when it was detected and all that sort of thing, right?
You know,
is it couple hundred grand, a couple million. Don't know. It would be interesting to know. I don't think it's a ton. I don't see a lot of anecdotal evidence of a lot of people reporting fraud activity. I think a lot of banks are being very proactive.
Yeah, I have heard and read anecdotes of it happening, but, you know, look, fraud happens all the time.
Yeah. You know? I mean, banks are certainly going to take a hit for the cost to reissue, but that's just probably doing business. And
yep.
It would be interesting when all said and done to really look at the true costs involved, who paid them, and what change was motivated by it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Amen.
So all right. That being said, I'm curious to see what the PCI console does, if anything. I think this will ultimately, you know, hurt the credibility a little bit, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yep. All right. So now we can move on. Next story is a report from Solutionary. This is a link on Slashdot. You know, basically, the U.S. is responsible for the majority of malware, or hosting the majority of malware. And within that, GoDaddy and Amazon are the top offenders. And, you know, it's can't really surprise anybody. It's so freaking easy.
How either could Danica Patrick do this to me?
Yes. Yes, she does do some naughty commercials.
Yeah.
This can't really be a big surprise. You know, I feel like I need to propose a law, and maybe I'll call it Callous Law or something like that. You know, that cloud machine, the easier we make it for people to set up virtual machines or servers on the internet, the worse the internet gets.
Well, then this brings up the question, is Amazon and other major cloud providers, is it incumbent upon them to watch their hosted machines for malicious behavior? Or are they purely a carrier, right? This comes down to this age-old debate.
Well, I think it's, at least in the U.S., I think it's pretty clear that it is it is the end customer, and right. that's responsible. Now the question becomes one of a moral issue, because, you know, they are quite literally making the internet a more dangerous place. You know, by virtue of hosting some of these sites that in turn get compromised or are in fact intentionally set up.
Hang on a minute, I got to get my soapbox out.
Go ahead.
How is it Amazon's fault that people are misusing them? That's like saying that because it's easier to buy a gun, the bad guy, when he goes and shoots somebody, it's the moral responsibility of the gun manufacturer to make it harder to get that gun. I disagree. It is not Amazon or any other cloud provider's responsibility, in theory, or at least a moral obligation, in theory, to protect the internet from their users. They can't help you. Look, they've got a term of service that says you can't do this, right? Now, there may be a competitive advantage and there may be a good reason for them to say, all right, we're going to watch your behavior and fix it. But, you know, that gets really dicey.
I don't disagree with the intent of what you're saying. However, I think the difference is that as compared to many other aspects of such things, this has a direct, you know, this has a very direct impact on many other people.
Freedom comes with cost. Look, it does, right?
Well,
do you want to put everybody in a nice little AOL box and all they can do is click on the link? I mean, if you want to utilize the internet in a pure, raw form, that comes with risks and it comes with responsibilities. I get that it has a direct impact on other people. I get it. But so does me driving down the road.
So I guess the question is, should not not, is AOL liable?
You mean Amazon?
I'm sorry, AOL. is Amazon liable, but should Amazon be doing, more? And I say that because, you know, there's a lot of people that complain about how difficult it is to report, you know, abuse to Amazon and have them take action. And, it's true. And by the way,
I told them about my stepfather for years and they wouldn't do a thing.
And to your point though, they are, you know, they're in a very competitive business and it takes money, right? If they have to, you know, hire 20 or 30 people to go and lord over these, you know, these images that are, you know, running malicious crap, you know, that's going to make them price. That's going to impact their competitiveness.
True. And I think the other lesson here is that don't trust it just because it's hosted on Amazon, right? Again, we go back to assume all sites are hostile. You know, when you're visiting them, if you're trying to defend your environment.
Yeah. That's a good point. I do see a lot of Amazon IP space attacking my server, though. I will tell you that.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, what's Amazon going to do? Set up a huge automated, you know, IPS system with all the false positives that come from that? You know, I don't know.
There isn't a good answer. That's the problem. There isn't a good answer. And if they weren't here, they would probably be somewhere else. Although, having said that, I think one of the challenges is that some of these large cloud environments enable some of these attackers to scale their operations pretty readily and to move around. You know, so it adds some capability that they would it would be more difficult.
Instead of just popping a box out there and, you know, using that box for free, at least now the bad guys are paying some money into the economy, right? Generating revenue and taxes and helping feed Amazon's employees' children. Look, it's good. It's providing good capital into the environment from the bad guys' activity.
Well, so going back to where I was at the beginning of this.
You're going to kick me off the show, aren't you?
Yeah. It's been great. It's been great having you on, Andy. where I was originally going is certainly I think we know that the bad guys are buying cloud instances, you know, usually with stolen credit cards and whatnot. But I think that possibly the bigger issue is you have a lot of people who probably have no business running a server because it's really freaking easy and really freaking cheap in Amazon. And I think that creates kind of a cesspool. And so now attackers know that, you know, this range of IP addresses has a high likelihood of being something that I can get into and, you know, use for my purposes.
Agreed. I would just caution though, that we don't want to have a, you must be this tall to ride limitation on utilizing these services, right? We don't want to get elitist about it.
Yeah, fair enough.
At least to my eyes, right? You know, this also goes back to the old debate. Are ISPs responsible for the content that flows across their networks that their users are doing? Are ISPs responsible for filtering child porn?
No, right? Clearly not.
Right? And they say, wait, we're just a carrier, right? We are not responsible for that.
It's not possible for them to be.
We're not talking possible. We're talking about morally, right? You frame this in terms of a moral discussion.
Fair enough.
Right?
Fair enough.
So, you know, because I could just as easily say Amazon can't possibly monitor all of their cloud activity. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about should they?
Well, I guess I was thinking it more in terms of being responsive to complaints of abuse.
Well, that's a different story, and I agree that they need to be more responsive, right? But then again, you know, you can use the abuse line as a DOS.
Yeah, right? we have indeed see that.
Right, so you need some way to prove, or, you know, so then you got to do an investigation, and then you got to do all this stuff. And, you know, what if I'm on there and my competitor just starts putting in abuse complaints against my sites and starts disrupting my business?
It's a great idea. Well, I think there's probably a middle ground there, but you know.
You know what there isn't? Much time left.
There isn't. Anyhow, we'll get to our last story. Yeah, well, we'll pick up that last
for
next week. So
yeah, it's a good story. We definitely should keep it on the agenda for next week.
Absolutely. Anyhow, it has been a pleasure talking to you as always.
I'm glad that you allow me to spout my libertarian rants. Thank you.
No worries. Anyhow, I appreciate everyone's time, and it's always enjoyable talking security. So if you find this podcast interesting, or you know, you object to Mr. Kalit's libertarianism, or have any other feedback, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. We really do enjoy hearing from our listeners, and certainly we try to get back to everyone who writes us. You can find the show on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes and the links to all the stories we talk about. You can follow the show on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can follow Mr. Kellett's Twitter feed at Lerg, LERG, and you can follow me at MaliciousLink. With that, I bid you adieu for another week. Have a great one. Bye.
See you guys.